the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Milwaukee Bucks podcast comes at you. We know you're sad about the Milwaukee Bucks. They lost to the Toronto Raptors in the Eastern Conference Finals 4-2. They dropped 4 straight games. Kind of a stunning end to a remarkable season. I know you already know a lot of the details of what happened, so we're going to talk about it a little bit more in depth. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the Journal Sentinel podcast, and on the other line is Matt Velasquez, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel beat reporter covering the Milwaukee Bucks. Matt, we've got a lot of questions. We got to look ahead to what's facing this team in terms of contracts, finances, signing guys, and obviously look back at this sort of crazy and stark finish to the season. But let's get into things right away. First, most important question. When George Hill says he could compete with David Bakhtiari in a chugging contest, do you believe him? I have my doubts.
I have no reason to doubt him. I feel like, you don't say those kinds of things unless you fully believe it, truly believe it. I'm sure he is no stranger to shotgunning beers. He's called himself a top 10 shotgunner of all time. So I have to believe that that's what he's all about. And I know that, you know, he is definitely into, hunting and fishing and all that stuff. And I feel like shotgunning a beer while, you know, doing all that, it seems like it fits. So
that is a really good point.
I would love to see the competition come to pass. I'd love to see everyone get together and engage in the Milwaukee beer drinking tradition.
Yes, George Hill, not one to brag about himself, not very boastful, talkative. For him to say that, that is some strong game. Would love to see him back that up. We'll talk about George Hill here in just a minute and a lot of other guys on this roster. After I'm done chatting with Matt, we're going to have a conversation with former Bucks play-by-play voice Eddie Doucette. He was with the team for 16 seasons, notably in the early stages, the infancy of this franchise. He was there in 71 and 74 when the Bucks went to the finals. I chatted with him before the Toronto series began, so there's a little bit more optimism to the conversation than maybe there would be today. But we looked back at the 71, the 74 team. You can find a write-up about that at jsonline.com. I did embed the audio with him last week, so you may have already heard this interview, but I thought I'd tack it onto the podcast as well. Eddie Doucette, kind of a voice a lot of older Bucks fans in particular really remember, you know, associate with the Bucks. And it was great catching up with him. He definitely pays a lot of attention to the current Bucks and had a lot of optimism about this team. You know, there's a lot of bigger issues and bigger fish to fry, but let's go back to George Hill real quickly because I think we could start there. That's kind of an easy roster decision. They're not going to pick up his contract for $17 million this year, but I don't think it necessarily rules him out from being back with the Bucks. We're talking about a guy who had a tremendous postseason and was really important for them, and even in Game 6 was there in crunch time down the stretch. You couldn't take him off the floor at points in this postseason. What are the options with George Hill? Is there any chance we see him in a Bucks uniform next year?
I mean, there's always a chance. I think the thing with him is that, you know, the reason they got him, or one of the main reasons they got him, was because of the way his contract is structured. He's owed $18 million next season, but if they waive him before July 1st, so, you know, before the end of June, they will only have to pay him $1 million next year, which theoretically they can also stretch his contract. So instead of paying him $1 million next year and counting that all towards the salary cap, they can pay him, you know, $333,000 each of the next 3 years, and that way it's a smaller cap hit each year. And the thing with him is that it's going to be a little bit harder to bring him back. They don't have his bird rights. He would be an unrestricted free agent, and so the question would be, you know, what kind of contract could they offer him? And they'd have to really structure their contracts in such a way, because of the way the cap holds work, and their other free agents. They'd have to structure such a way that it'd be difficult to find the money to be able to pay him a non-minimum contract. It's not impossible. There also is the opportunity for the mid-level exception, or this year they broke up the mid-level exception a little bit, where Ersan Ilyasova gets part of it, Pat Connaughton's getting part of it. We'll see if they're able to do something like that in the future. It all depends on Brook Lopez too. That's somebody who they also don't have his bird rights, and so if they're going to want to re-sign him and do it at a bigger number, they'd probably have to use that mid-level exception. So how does that shake out? And Then you get into issues of possibly hard capping yourself, and then what about Mirotić? I mean, so we there's a lot of complications there, but it really just comes down to what the Bucks are looking for, what George Hill is looking for, and if they're able to figure out a way to bring those two sides together. George, much to the ire of Utah Jazz fans, who were the ones who initially gave him, who lost him to a contract. They had him and he played well, and then he went to Sacramento for a 3-year, $57 million contract, the one that he's currently on. George Hill said during exit interviews, "Oh, money's not the most important thing. I came from a family where we didn't have money. You know, it's not like I've always had it. Like, it's not a big deal." And Jazz fans were like, "What? Like, money's that important? Like, you went to the Kings, take it all with a grain of salt." But, George did say that, money, at least he said the money is not the most important thing to him. He wants to find a place where he can be stable and have trust between himself and his team, and it can be the right situation for his family. And he did find those things, he said, in Milwaukee, but, there's still, questions as to if that can be a fit going forward in terms of team and salary cap and all that stuff. So a lot to figure out.
Believe it or not, that's one of the easier questions that the Bucks have, is what to do with George Hill, not necessarily whether or not they bring him back, but they're not going to pick up his contract. Like, by July 1st, he's not going to be with the Bucks. The question, what happens after that? So we will get in the weeds a little bit more about that. Mid-level exception, like you brought up, I feel like is pretty much going to be dedicated specifically to Brook Lopez. We're going to talk about him. Before I go back into the salary machinations, let's quickly look back at this series. The Bucks obviously showed no signs that they would be the type of team that could lose four times in a row to anybody in any situation, and then yet that's exactly what they did. Had a 2-0 series lead, lost a double overtime game that will be looked back upon as the turning point of the series, a game that Toronto led for the most part, but the Bucks could have stolen, and had they stolen it, there would have been a Game 7 on Memorial Day at the very least. Perhaps the Bucks fight through either Game 5 or Game 6 and win in that case. It's just a really frustrating postscript to a season that had been so exciting, 60 wins, leading the NBA, etc., etc. There's been a lot of conversation about it. Kawhi Leonard was amazing. Fred VanVleet was amazing. The Bucks were up against a really good team. But as you look at this situation, was there what would you point to as the thing that was missing that the Bucks did not have that they needed? And maybe it was guys just hitting shots. Maybe it was the right type of player for a certain situation. Maybe it was the right type of defense. What was the one thing the Bucks did not have that they needed that could have tilted the scales the other direction?
I think at the end of the day, they just couldn't close out games. I mean, they were right there in Game 3, in Game 5, in Game 6. You look at, obviously, Game 3 being the double overtime game. They trailed the whole game. They were able to bring it to overtime, mostly thanks to Pascal Siakam missing a couple free throws in the last 10 seconds. And so they gave themselves a chance to win, but they never actually got over the hump. They didn't have those clean possessions. They didn't execute as well as they needed to. I mean, you're looking at a tight game, in Game 3, and it's in the first overtime. And you have back-to-back turnovers that, instead of the game being tied, now the Bucks are suddenly down 4, amazingly, they tie the game again. So you go to the second overtime, and they're within 2. It's just they can't get over the hump. And that was the big issue for them in that game. You look at Game 5, and the biggest difference was that fourth quarter. I mean, they were up going into the fourth quarter, and you get, Kawhi Leonard and Fred VanVleet and all the stuff that they were doing, like, they're the ones who are putting the Raptors over the edge. Meanwhile, the Bucks only score, a couple baskets in the last few minutes. Like, there were too many fouls, too many missed opportunities, and they kind of just unraveled at the end. The same can be said for Game 6, where the Bucks were up 15 with over 2 minutes left in the third quarter, and then suddenly there's this, avalanche of a run from the Raptors. Kawhi Leonard goes off, You know, he was able to kind of get going with his shot. You know, he had been held down for a lot of the day. He only made 1 3-pointer in the game out of 8 tries, and that came late in the game. And so he kind of gets rolling. You know, he's really setting the tone. The Raptors are clamping down defensively in the Bucks' half-court offense, which was part of their fourth-quarter struggles throughout the series. Their half-court offense suddenly is stuck in the mud. They can't create enough open looks. They can't get enough looks like open or contested. They can't get enough things to fall. They just couldn't close out the games. And so, you know, when you have Kawhi Leonard playing at the, you know, just extraordinary level that he's playing, and Fred VanVleet doing a Steph Curry impression for 3 straight games. I think he went 14 of 17 in the last 3 games of the series. Just ridiculous. Which, you know, it's the kind of thing where you can't overcome that if you're not executing at a high level. And the Bucks didn't execute at a high enough level late in games, in the games they lost. You know, they got their own somewhat outlier performance in game one from Brook Lopez, who he was huge throughout that game and the fourth quarter to help them claim that game one victory. But after that, they didn't get those supporting guys to contribute at a high enough level at the end to, you know, to fend off Kawhi and Steph VanVleet.
Yeah, like you're kind of indicating, the Lopez game was great, but ultimately the Bucks didn't have that unexpected performance to match what Fred VanVleet was able to do. George Hill was great off the bench, but when you consider that Eric Bledsoe and Chris Middleton overall in this series were not the factors that we've seen them be at times this season, they just did not have that extra oomph to come from some direction. And that was how the Raptors were able to win this one in 6. There's a follow-up question to this, and I think you'll kind of know where that'll ultimately go. But there was a little talk about Giannis and how he could get better, and how there's still some growth available to him. He's only 24 years old. That's not a controversial thing to say. This was a series where Giannis was not quite at the level that we've seen him at points in the regular season. I mean, maybe it's just simply because he was outshined by Kawhi, who played unbelievable basketball and definitely looked like an MVP throughout the series. It's not that Giannis's numbers were bad or the production was all that low, but when you evaluate how Giannis fared in this Toronto series, there's a little bit to the fact that we didn't see him as aggressive as he was, perhaps because his free throws weren't falling and he was not feeling like it was a sure thing to get to the line, get points that way. What do you see from him, and do you feel like there is more Giannis could have done here in this Toronto series?
Well, I think there's more that everybody could have done, and he's certainly included in that. I think that, you know, in the playoffs, things get a lot tougher. I mean, starting in game 3, he was defended by Kawhi, you know, a 2-time defensive player of the year, you know, a former finals MVP, somebody who is, you know, widely regarded as one of the best, you know, perimeter defenders in the NBA, who's also one of the most versatile defenders in the NBA. Like, yes, he's giving up size, but he has that super long wingspan. He has, you know, the athletic ability to get up and block shots. He has the strength to kind of bow up against Giannis when he tries to back him down. And plus, he was getting help from behind with guys sliding over, especially on Giannis's post-ups. And so, you know, it took, you know, an extraordinary, you know, otherworldly defender to slow down Giannis. I mean, this isn't like, you know, he got D'd up by, you know, somebody who, you know, we don't regard as having the chops. Like, this is one of the best the NBA has to offer. And, you know, that's why the test was so great, was because, you know, he is so good, and he is such a vacuum at that end where he can, you know, the ball gets near him and he's going to steal it. So if you're Giannis, like, you know, and you're driving, like, you have to be, like, incredibly careful with the ball, because if you make any slight misstep, if you dribble it just a little too far away from your body, if you throw a pass that you telegraph, like, just the smallest amount, Kawhi is going to deflect it. He's going to steal it. He's going to wreak havoc. And so I think the thing for Giannis was, I think that he did adjust. He did get better. Game 3, you know, was his worst game of the series. One where, you know, maybe if he can figure things out a little bit quicker, the Bucks can win that game. And maybe the series goes a whole different way. He only had 12 points in that game. Kawhi did a really good job at holding him down, making things tough, making his decisions tough. And so he's out there, and you can see him like having to run through these decisions like in real time. And it's not easy, especially with the way that the Raptors defense, you know, along with Kawhi, like they played really well. And they were able to move together and work together, and they had great communication so that switches didn't always come from the same places. And so reading that in real time was difficult. And, you know, talking to Giannis after the series on exit interview day on Monday, you know, he was saying that he felt like he was learning and he was getting better like every game, and that he was watching the film and he was progressing, and he could feel like himself making that progress and getting better and starting to find the gaps and the ways that he could score, and, you know, understanding where his shots needed to come from. And like, these are the types of things and the types of experiences that he's going to have to learn from and grow from in the future. I mean, now that he's reached the Eastern Conference Finals and had that level of defense and that type of defense played against him, you know, he's seen it before. And he's going to add that to his memory bank, add that to you know, the way that he approaches future games, so that maybe next time he can start to pick things up faster. That's something that he realizes that he needs to do, and he did realize it throughout the series, and, you know, and hopes that this can change the future when he reaches these points again.
And here's the aforementioned follow-up in regards to that future. Malika Andrews of ESPN, shortly after Game 6 wrapped up, posted a story suggesting that Giannis would essentially entertain leaving Milwaukee after the 2020 season if he judged that the team wasn't going to make the finals or wasn't capable of making the finals. Wasn't very clear on that, but that taps into kind of everyone's greatest fear as a Midwestern sports fan in general, but certainly as a fan of the Milwaukee Bucks, that Giannis would eschew supermax money here in Milwaukee, which I'm sure the team would be willing to pay him, for an opportunity to win somewhere else. I wonder kind of what you make of that. I know you've gotten to know Malika Andrews over the course of the season covering the Bucks. There was this awkward exchange in the post-game interview room where Malika asked a question related to experience in the postseason, and Giannis got up and walked away. It wasn't clear if that was related to this particular story, but sort of in the immediate aftermath, it kind of is stirring the pot a little bit for Milwaukee fans who are nervous that he may not want to stay, particularly because the implication is that he wasn't well equipped with the pieces around him to get to that level, when obviously that is what this Bucks team was. They led the league in wins and were 10-1 in the playoffs at one point. Hard to feel like this team wasn't equipped to get to the finals. What did you make of the whole thing, of the story, of him leaving the podium, of that concern? How valid is that? How much should Milwaukee Bucks fans worry about this?
Well, I think none of this should be that surprising. And let me kind of follow that by saying, we've always known that Giannis wants to win. Like, he's always said that. That's been the public sentiment. That is what the Bucks have said. Like, that is the number one thing. He's a competitive guy. He wants to win. And if he believes he can win in Milwaukee, then, you know, that is going to give the Bucks every opportunity to re-sign him and give him that supermax next summer. You know, the idea that if he doesn't think the Bucks can win, that he might leave, like, that's always been the idea. You know, I think with the story, I didn't see it until after the incident at the podium. But like, it came out like right as the game ended, you know, just a few minutes after. And, you know, that could blindside everyone. I mean, that could blindside Giannis, that could blindside the team. You know, if there's a, you know, if she has a source in there that said, you know, that making the finals next year could tip the scales, like, that means that not making the finals would mean that the scales are basically even, like, or that, you know, heading into that, if they don't make the finals, like, he could leave or he could stay. I mean, that's going to be the question of the whole year. Honestly, I'm sure Giannis will handle it well. I'm sure he'll have a plan for how to discuss that situation. I don't think we're going to have an Anthony Davis situation on our hands. I think the Bucks will do everything in their power during free agency and possibly even go into the luxury tax to assemble the best possible roster around Giannis to give them every opportunity to advance deep in the playoffs again. They all believe, you know, from the players to the coaches to the front office, that this roster was good enough to make the finals, and that it, if kept together or even, you know, bolstered with other, you know, additions, that could be, it could be good enough to make the finals next year. I mean, the NBA changes a lot year to year, and it's hard to continue a level of that level of success, you know, but that's been the stated goal for John Horst and the front office for, you know, as long as they've been there. They've said, hey, we want to be successful and do it for a long time. And so all the moves they've made have been so that, you know, have been such that they can, you know, do what they did this year and, you know, roll it forward. And I think when it comes to Giannis, you know, he didn't discuss leaving the podium at his exit interviews. He didn't discuss any of that type of stuff. Though we, you know, going back to that, like, we did get a great new meme of Chris Middleton, who was was taken by surprise. So I do appreciate that. He didn't discuss that, but what he did say, you know, was that there's going to be many more good things to come. You know, he said he's excited about the team, believing in the team. And just to quote him, he said, "And we're going to get it done, step by step, day by day, year by year. It might take 1 year, it might take 2 years, it might take 5 years, but we're going to get it done. We're close to it. We've worked for 5 years for this, 6 years for this." And I just said, 15 wins. Now we've got 60. I don't promise we're going to get 61 next year, but we're gonna be who we want to be. We're going to put ourselves in a place to be a championship-contending team for many more years to come. And there's not a lot of teams that can say that in the league. You know, he's like, oh, there's only one, two, three, four teams that can say that, but we're going to do it. We're going to put ourselves in a situation for many years to come. So he at least is sending out the message that he's not going anywhere. And that could be meaningless, sure. Like, you know, players say that they want to be places all the time and they want to do things, and then suddenly things change. But at the very least, like, that's the messaging that he's putting out there. And until that changes, it at least is now still in line with everything else he's said. You know, he's always said that he appreciates Milwaukee. He loves Milwaukee. He's enjoyed his time with the Bucks. He believes that he and they can win together. And so this all kind of, you know, follows along with that. And, you know, and until he does something like, you know, like Anthony Davis or Kyrie Irving last year, when he said, oh, I want to be with the Celtics forever. And then suddenly a few months in, you know, he's like, you know, we'll see what happens this summer. Like, again, until the messaging changes, you know, I still think that the Bucks have a very good chance to retain him. You know, obviously he's allowed to change his mind, and as everyone is, but, you know, I just see, just from the way that he's handled these types of issues publicly in the past, that he will have a plan and will probably spend most of the year getting those questions and responding to them by saying, "Hey, I just want to focus on basketball right now. Like, that's all I want to do." Just off of knowing him, I expect that'll be the answer. And Bucks fans, no matter what he says, will continue to be nervous, because Bucks fans are Bucks fans.
Yes. Well, still smarting generations later, when Kareem decided to go to one of the coasts, so or decided that he wanted to go to one of the coasts. Bucks actually made out pretty good in that trade, but many people will never forget that. So that will always be lingering in the background, even if it does look promising that he returns to the Bucks after 2020 and stays here for a long time. Well, so
and to add to that, like, and I get it. Like, I'm not trying to disparage Bucks fans. Like, I know that, like, you know, 18 years ago, the Bucks made the Eastern Conference Finals, and then they bring in Anthony Mason, and like that free agent signing or that trade does not work out the way it's intended. Things sour with the team. Suddenly, by August 2002, like one season later, Glenn Robinson is traded. The big three is broken up. Gary Payton trade happens. Like, and the Bucks just fall into, you know, a pit for for the past 18 years. So I get that, like, these things can unravel quickly, and the window can close, as soon as it opens. And, you know, success is not promised for a long period of time. And so, like, you know, going from this season to this critical summer where a lot of things could change, players could leave, the roster could get shaken up, like, there is reason for, you know, some doubt. There's reason for apprehension. And, you know, we'll have to see how the next few months go as the Bucks prepare for, you know, the harder thing. You know, they made the jump. Now the hard thing to do is to sustain it.
You can read more about Matt Velasquez's impressions from these exit interviews that he's talking about at jsonline.com. A lot of conversation with the other players as well. Chris Middleton, Brooke Lopez, and Malcolm Brogdon are probably the big three we can refer to when we're talking about contract situations here in the offseason. As we talk about this roster and what the Bucks would want to do, whether they want to bring all those key pieces back and try to just replicate what they did, or if maybe they make a move in another direction. Three very different situations. Brogdon is a restricted free agent. The Bucks will have the right to match any amount of money offered by another franchise. Brooke Lopez, we talked about the mid-level exception a little bit. Seems like he would be the candidate to receive pretty much all of that, or most of that. And Middleton, the unrestricted free agent, who's probably going to get a max deal from somewhere. Most likely Milwaukee will be the one to offer, but it's unclear if he would like to take maybe a bigger spotlighted role somewhere else. I'm also curious if the Bucks do wind up in conversations with one of the many, many big-time free agents that are out there. I mean, I don't think necessarily Kyrie or Kawhi would be one of those guys. Anthony Davis. I mean, there are a lot of guys out there who are probably going to be thinking about new teams. Kevin Durant, of course, is rumored to be going to New York or the LA Clippers or whatever. I'd be curious to know if the Bucks look at what they have now and say, okay, well, this team was really good, but we did ultimately get beat by a team that has one superstar like we do and a bunch of role players like we do, or, you know, slightly better than role players, and they were better than us. So maybe we need to take that one extra step and bring in another guy who you would classify as a 1B to Giannis's 1A. I don't know if that's possible financially. I don't know how they would go about doing that. It would probably mean getting rid of all three of these guys. I don't know. But as you look at Middleton, Lopez, Brogdon, who do you think is the most likely to come back? And maybe the answer is all three. Maybe you think all three. And which one is going to be the trickiest to retain?
Yeah, I think when all is said and done, I think I'd order them in terms of likelihood of coming back as Middleton, Lopez, Brogdon. But I think that they all have a very good chance of coming back. I think with Chris Middleton, it's pretty cut and dried. Like, they're going to have to offer him a max contract or close to a max contract if they want him to stay. He's obviously been really important to them throughout the past few years. They've discussed openly how much they want to keep him. They know it's not going to involve a hometown discount. And I think that there's some peace there. Or at least some they know what it takes. And like, in order to get another free agent that's around the max level, they would have to renounce Middleton, renounce Brogdon, basically renounce all their guys, so they would not have their cap holds counting against them, and that would open up the max money. They would have to. And I'm not sure if they have to renounce every single one of those guys. Obviously, there's Mirotić and Hill. There's a lot of cap holds. We can get into the weeds on that in a future podcast. But they'd have to renounce a bunch of guys and not bring them back, because with Middleton, they have his bird rights, which means they are allowed to go over the cap to re-sign him. They can also offer him 5 years, which no other team can do. Other teams only offer him 4. And so, I think that there's, a pretty clear understanding by the Bucks of what it's going to take to re-sign Chris Middleton if he wants to return. He said that his family and doing the best thing for his family is the most important thing for him, and the fit comes second to that. If we're going to prioritize like the tiers of what he wants to find the best thing for himself and his family, then he wants to find the team with the best fit. But he was also asked about, having unfinished business with Giannis. They've been together for 6 years, and they've taken the team from 15 wins now to 60. And he said, yeah, that there is some unfinished business, and they believe that they can do more than what they've done. And so I think there's a mutual interest in him coming back. And so if the Bucks can offer him that fit, they can offer him the money and say, hey, we're not going to shortchange you. We're not going to devalue you. I think that this is something that could get done pretty quickly in terms of free agency, which, by the way, in case anyone hasn't seen it, free agency will now start in the afternoon at 5 p.m. on June 30th instead of at 11 p.m. Central on June 30th going into July 1st. So that's nice. Don't have to have a slumber party and keep track of free agency. But I think that that's the kind of thing where if the Bucks are willing to pay the money, which all indications so far are that they will be, that they can bring him back, and they can do that. And you know, it's one of those things where I know some fans would say, "Oh, he's not worth the max. He is not as valuable as that to the team to be making 30% of their cap, all that type of stuff." And like, yes, like there are not all max guys are created equal, right? Like, not every max guy is Giannis, or not every max guy is Kevin Durant or LeBron. Like, you know, some max guys are Mike Conley. You know, some max, and Mike Conley's a great player.
Yes, like, Memphis is definitely moving on from him, though, if they can.
I mean, yeah, but you know, they are in a rebuilding part of their you know, franchise. They have had success. They've gone to the Western Conference Finals before with Conley. You know, he hasn't been an All-Star, which is kind of criminal. Like, he's really, really good. You know, some max guys are Steph Curry, some max guys are John Wall. Like, there are all kinds of different max guys, but it just comes down to which teams have the money, you know, which teams have the cap space. You know, I remember a few years ago, it looks bad now, but like, the Wizards gave, you know, John Wall a max, Bradley, you know, they gave Bradley Beal a big contract, they gave Otto Porter a max because they had to match. There was a restricted situation. They had to decide what to do. And it's like, at that time, like, if they didn't bring him back, like, they were gonna get nothing in return and not be good. So it's like, you know, certain times just the cap situation and the available free agents, like, they dictate who gets a max. And it's not like Chris Middleton at max money, who maintains his health, is going to be a valueless player. Or, you know, he might be slightly overvalued, but he's not going to be, like, it's not going to be a terrible contract. The cap has continued to go up. It will continue to go up based on future projections. Like, obviously, his money tied to the cap at 30% would go with that over the life of the contract. But it's not unmovable. It's not like a, you know, albatross around your neck, in the same way that, like, John Wall, because he got hurt, is killer. So I think that this is the only way that the Bucks can get a player at the level of of Chris Middleton, while also being able to keep, you know, Brooke Lopez and Malcolm Brogdon and potentially other free agents, or any combination that you want of the guys that they have. If they were to let Middleton go, they don't necessarily have the cap space to bring those guys back and bring in a maximal player because of the way the cap works and his bird rights. So if you're willing to trade Middleton and Brogdon for a higher tier or free agent, you know, I think that's a calculation you have to make based on who that free agent is. If the Bucks hear that they can get Kevin Durant, then forget everyone else. Like, you know, like, I get it. You know, if they find out that, you know, that Kawhi Leonard, after seeing the Bucks in the Eastern Conference Finals, is like, hey, I'm a fun guy, I can go play in Milwaukee with Giannis, that'd be fun.
Did you just say Kawhi's a fun guy? That's a take.
Well, that's what he's called himself before. He when asked about himself earlier in the season, he's like, oh, I'm a fun guy.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
my goodness.
But, you know, obviously these things are like pipe dreams, right? Like, those things aren't going to happen. There are teams tailor-made with one or two max slots that they can give to a free agent, and guys can go elsewhere. And so if you want to find, like I said, if you want to find somebody who is at the caliber of Chris Middleton, who is, you know, who is available this summer, and you can sign him, like, okay, like, but the Bucks have to figure out who else they're going to lose by signing that player, because they will not have that player's bird rights and would not be able to go over to the cap to sign that player, and how much, you know, that would affect things. So so I think Chris Middleton is pretty straightforward. I think Brooke Lopez, there is also a mutual interest there. He could very easily, you know, take his talents and get paid, you know, a pretty sizable contract. It all depends on what he wants. The mid-level exception might be, you know, might be lower than his market value, depending on what teams are willing to spend based on what he's done. But there's a, you know, I think there's an interest, and so they'll have to see, you know, if they can make that work, if that fit could be enough. And the Malcolm Brogdon, like you said, they can match any offers. The question is, will they even let it get to that point? You know, there have been other players that, you know, like Chris Middleton, they didn't get to the point back in 2015 when he was a restricted free agent. They didn't get to the point of other teams giving him an offer sheet. They just signed a deal. Like they agreed to it very quickly. I think it might have even been on July 1st. And they got him locked up before other teams made some offers. So could they do that with Malcolm Brogdon? That's totally possible. You know, this could be his one big chance for a payday. You know, he's made less than $4 million, which, you know, to the average person is a ton. To the NBA player is a very small amount. He's made that over 3 years. And, you know, he is, you know, in his, you know, getting toward his late 20s. Like, this is the time that this is like the one chance in his prime to get a big dollar number, like to really make, you know, a generational amount of money that just changes your family forever. And so it behooves him to take advantage of that and to, you know, maybe see what the market will offer. And if there are any teams that are be willing to, at the very least, you know, push the Bucks and say, hey, we're going to give him this huge offer sheet. We dare you to match it because we know it's going to mess with your finances, you know, and then the Bucks have to make a difficult decision. And so I think that's probably the reason why it'd be more difficult with him, just because the market can more directly impact, you know, what the Bucks pay, and it could force them to pay more than they want to or had planned to. So I think those guys are all in a tricky situation in terms of how much money and how many years and what exactly they're looking for. And, you know, I think mentioning Malcolm and his big payday, like, this is Chris Middleton's last shot at a really huge number. You know, and he's already made some money in his career. But still, like, I do not look down upon any person who wants to make the absolute most possible for their services. Because that's how I feel about my life. And I want to make as much money as I can if someone's willing to offer me that money. And I'm sure most people feel that way, especially when it's, you know, it's like, oh, I can play for this team or play for this team. And I'd be doing the same thing. And, you know, we could be successful. Those guys are all going to be super interesting. And we'll get into all that more. Obviously, I talked a lot about that just now. But we can get in even more nitty-gritty on a podcast before free agency hits.
Yeah, I wanted to riff with you a little bit, and I'm not going to now. I personally think you can argue that Brook Lopez is fundamentally the most important of the three in how his presence, his skill set, altered what the Bucks were able to do. And obviously, you don't want to lose any one of those guys. But my thought is that Brook Lopez might actually be the most important guy to bring back, because you can't find anybody to match what he's capable of doing. But we might have to talk about that a little bit more. Like you said, it's fascinating to see if there is any interest from somebody else out there who wants to play with Giannis. Let's say it is a Kawhi Leonard or Kevin Durant. That's going to complicate things, because the Bucks then have to evaluate their own guys. That is going to be a fascinating series of circumstances.
It doesn't even have to really be Kawhi Leonard or Kevin Durant necessarily. Obviously, that'd be great. I think everybody who's a Bucks fan would be like, hey, that'd be really nice to have that guy. You know, alongside Giannis, but like, have the Bucks reached the point where they are thought of so highly as a franchise, as a front office, as an ownership that's willing to set the team up for success, as a roster with their returning guys, including Giannis, as a team that free agents would want to take a discount to play for. Guys would say, you know, you might start getting like the ring chasers or the veterans who are like, you know what, I'm done with being on bad teams. I'm willing to, you know, I just want to win. And so I want to go to this team where all they talk about all year is their really good chemistry and super good culture and the fun that they've had and like the way that, you know, Bud has put them in these positions. And, you know, he may very well be the coach of the year this year. He probably will be when they announce that on June 24th. You know, they have the guy who just won the MVP or finished highly in the MVP voting. I would expect Giannis will win, again, announced on June 24th. But like, so do players look at that and go, you know what, how can I get a piece of that? You know, and it doesn't need to be like signing for a big number. It could be just be the guys who fill out the roster. And if you're filling out the roster with a bunch of quality guys who are just looking for a really good situation and maybe a springboard, like, you know, to say, all right, you know what, instead of like toiling away on this team that isn't going anywhere, whatever, you know, some non-playoff team, and maybe putting up some stats, I want to go somewhere and be part of a winning team and be able to demonstrate my value on a higher, on a bigger stage to maybe get a future bigger contract. But right now I just want to like demonstrate value or just win or chase for a ring or whatever. Like, can the Bucks draw in a few of those guys and really maximize their success in free agency along the fringes? You know, maybe you could make the argument that maybe Brooke Lopez was one of those guys last summer. Maybe he saw some things that other people didn't see, or maybe it's just the market wasn't there for him. But can they get guys like Brooke Lopez who will sign for a smaller amount of money, but, you know, be able to have this like outsized impact on the team? And if they can do that and they can continue to have you know, a lot of depth and just a roster of guys where no matter who they put in, like, they are able to contribute, you know, that can make the difference too.
So here's a name we haven't said yet, and this will be the last question I ask you before I finally let you go here. A name we haven't said is Nico Mirotic. He disappeared in this series and quite honestly has not worked out on a grand scale. There were games where he hit some shots, but he wasn't good enough defensively to stay on the floor. His plus minus was terrible, and he wasn't hitting shots. And early in the series, it was just inconsistent to the point where he did not get on the floor in game six. In crunch time, they ultimately decided Nico wasn't playable anymore. Does this series sort of cloud any possibility of him coming back? I mean, maybe he just doesn't have it in him. I think you could definitely make the argument that he does have it in him and he just didn't play well with the Bucks, was coming off injury, whatever you want to call it. He would be the type of guy who could theoretically do what Brooke Lopez does to maybe a slightly lesser degree and hit a bunch of shots. Do the Bucks entertain trying to bring him back, or is this series going to be sort of his last stand in Milwaukee?
This is one of the more interesting questions. Because I think that on paper and at times during the regular season, like, he did fit, like, he did work. You know, he worked in the Celtics series. You know, obviously they put him into the starting lineup after that game one loss to the Celtics. And then, you know, things started to work out. Like, they had like generally good numbers, at least in the regular season with that lineup. They had, obviously a small sample size, but what he brings with his size, his 3-point shooting, he wasn't as bad defensively at times as people might think. I was kind of impressed by the way that he handled covering Jaylen Brown in that Boston series, and really took that challenge and made things difficult at times. And he played with you know, pretty high level of intensity, and was really active on the defensive end. But in the Toronto series, like, you know, a streaky shooter went cold. You know, the same can be said for Danny Green on the Raptors. I mean, if the Raptors had lost the series, you know, I feel like there'd be a lot of consternation regarding Danny Green. And he's someone who, you know, is an all defensive player, a former champion with the Spurs, a guy who's proven it and made huge shots in big games. You know, I'm not saying that Mirotić is any of those things. He's definitely not all defense. He hasn't won a championship. You know, but, you know, they're both primarily known as shooters, and neither of them showed up shooting wise in the series. And so Mirotić, it's going to be, you know, he's definitely not among the likes of Chris Middleton and Brooke Lopez and Malcolm Brogdon in terms of priorities, you know, and so it all comes down to, you know, what they can get him for, what the market eventually is for him. Yeah, you know, I would expect that some team would say, "Ah, well, that was an outlier performance. Like, he's better than that. We're gonna throw him some money this summer," you know. But does he want to do that? Does he want to take money somewhere that maybe isn't the best fit for him? You know, I can see him. I mean, he's somebody who I can see fitting with, you know, like the Houston Rockets, for example, right? Like, they do things very similar to the Bucks. They would value him as a shooter, you know, and all that stuff. Like, you know, do they make a run at him? Do, you know, the Warriors, like, they're going to need more shooting, especially if KD leaves. Like, they might need more help off the bench. Like, do they want his help? You know, or is there a team that, you know, that we don't know of right now? Some team that, you know, they shift around a bunch of pieces and maybe they think that there's a spot for him. And maybe he could even start for that team. I don't know. So the market for him is really interesting. Before this series, I would expect that, you know, teams would be very easily sold on what he can do. And so maybe some teams will be slightly more hesitant this summer. And also, does he want to take? Is he one of those guys who will take less money in order to, you know, be in the right situation to be on a winning team? You know, that might be something that he values. But he's still young. He still has, you know, his career in front of him. He still can make money this contract and then, you know, hunt for success later. And so, you know, I think that the way the Bucks handle him will be super interesting. I wonder if they'll, you know, be in the tax or be near the tax and give Lopez the full mid-level exception and thereby hard cap themselves and just not have enough money for Mirotić and say, sorry, like, you know, we made our choice. Now we're hard capped and now we can't offer you anything substantial. So you can take a minimum or that's it. Like maybe they do that. And that's kind of their way of like letting him go by hard capping themselves. But it's, like I said, it's interesting, and I can see it going a lot of different directions.
He is Matt Velasquez, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel beat reporter, covering the Milwaukee Bucks. He knows all about this crazy offseason stuff that that Bucks fans will be trying to pay attention to. We're going to have you back again, Matt. We're not going to do this next week, but as we get closer to the draft, we'll do this again. We'll preview the draft. We'll talk more about the contract stuff because I know a lot of people out there don't understand how mid-level exception works or when you say they're hard-capping themselves or what that means. So we'll maybe get a little bit more into the weeds on some of that and precisely figure out what decisions are facing the Bucks. But the draft and free agency kind of begin back-to-back with each other, so we will chat then. Thanks for stopping by, my friend.
All right. Thanks for having me. Thanks for a great season.
Thank you to Matt for joining us extra long today, and we've got more for you at this interview with Eddie Doucette, former Bucks broadcaster. He did radio, TV, first 16 seasons of the Bucks franchise history, which means he saw some of the greatest Bucks teams there were, specifically the 71 championship team, the 74 team that lost in seven games in the NBA Finals to the Boston Celtics. He saw the entire six seasons of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Oscar Robertson, some of the players that came after him in the early 80s, some of the greats that swung through Milwaukee. So I really enjoyed chatting with him, hearing his voice, talking about those teams, comparing them to today. Again, this interview was conducted before the start of the Raptors series, so he's talking about his impressions of the Bucks, how exciting they are to him. Obviously, things have changed a little bit given the outcome, but it's still really cool to hear from Eddie Doucette. Lives in California and is clearly following the Bucks a lot. Eddie stays very involved with the Mac Fund and did come back to Milwaukee recently for a Mac Fund event. If you don't know, Eddie is the guy who coined a couple phrases that became sort of commonplace both in Milwaukee and beyond. The skyhook, the term that you know, basically Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's go-to move, that is a term that Eddie Doucette essentially coined. He also coined the name Bango for the mascot Bucks, the Bucks mascot Bango. That is an Eddie Doucette creation. So it was fun to chat with him about all this stuff. So here, again, this was at jsonline.com last week. You may have already heard it. And if so, thanks for tuning in. But if you are especially a fan of the Bucks for a long time, I think you'll enjoy hearing from Eddie Doucette. I'm now speaking to Eddie Doucette. He was the play-by-play radio voice of the Milwaukee Bucks when the franchise first started. He was there for 16 years, all the way through the 1984 season. Many old Bucks fans will know his voice very well. Mr. Doucette, thank you for joining me. The Bucks, of course, are in a really good spot here in the Eastern Conference Finals. They haven't been to the finals since 1974 when you of course, got to see them play up close and personal. For starters, before I get into the Bucks, can you kind of give a sense of what the entire state of the NBA was like during those 16 years in Milwaukee and kind of where NBA fell in the culture, if it was as beloved maybe as it is today?
Sure. First of all, I was radio and TV. We didn't have much TV, but I was able to do 25, 30 games a year for the Bucks back in those days. Of course, it's a different animal now. It's all year long. So the exposure was different. The culture was different then than it is now, obviously, because of exposure. And the marketing has really taken a hold of the NBA and created the giant that it's become. It's an entertainment media. And, you know, back then, even at my particular position, I always had the feeling that I was to inform and entertain. And I always used to tell people, hey, look, you want information and nothing more, just get the Journal or the Sentinel. And we had two of them back then. And but I'd like to try to dress things up a little bit and make it a little bit more colorful. And so it wasn't all about just the facts or information. It was about having a little fun and progressing in that manner. And, of course, it has gotten more and more to that point today. It's the emphasis, I would think, in the NBA today because of the marketing is more on the entertainment side, which is the side that is producing the dollars. And because of that, it has become a giant. Now, remember, back then, we had, at the time the Bucks won the championship, 17 teams. So you were seeing other teams a lot more than you are now.
Sure.
And that, of course, that familiarity was in itself a good opportunity to do a little extra scouting because you got a chance to know each other pretty well. It's a little different now. Of course, the schedule was the same in terms of length, 82 games. We enjoyed the fruits of the home floor at the old barn, the Mecca, back in those days, winning 34 games. I think the Bucks won 33 at home this year, if I'm not mistaken. And so a lot of things are lining up to be very similar because when that happened back in 1970-71, that season when we won the championship, we were fortunate enough to get Oscar Roberts, and that really tilted the fortunes in our favor. But we also signed on Bob Boozer and Lucius Allen. Those were big gets for us. And, of course, Lou Alcindor, now Kareem, was just entering his third year in the league. So an opportunity to play with a gilded performer like Oscar Roberts, and in my mind, arguably the best guy that ever played the game because he played both ends of the floor and was a leader on top of it, and his IQ was off the charts. So all the signs of good fortune were pointing in the direction of the Bucks back in those days. So yes, things have evolved. Yes, things have gotten different because of the magnanimousness of the game, the new arenas, the television contracts, all of the hoopla that surrounds the game today. And it's just a huge, huge money venture. Back then, it was another game. And you reported it like you would report baseball or football. And, of course, in my case, tried to color it a little bit to make it even more exciting. But, yeah, it's changed dramatically. And because of that, we have this big-time show coming up in Milwaukee tonight. First time, if I recall, the first time the Bucks have been to the final round in 45 years, and the first time that seeking to get to the final round for the first time in 45 years, and Toronto for the first time ever.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun, I think. The 1971 season, there's a parallel to this year in this sense. The Bucks were really terrible 5 years ago. They had won 15 games, so they weren't, in a way, even though Bucks fans have been kind of excited and waiting for this for a long time, there is a little bit of a sudden turnaround. In 1971, the franchise hadn't even been around 5 years, so I'm curious how the fans, in your estimation, how the city embraced it. Was it, I mean, because the Milwaukee Brewers are brand new at that point. I don't know what the relationship is to a baseball team being back in town. I imagine there was a curiosity, but I don't know if you had a lot of diehards then because the franchise was so young. Did you get a sense that it was a tough sell at all to get Bucks fever going in Milwaukee, or was this a fan base that just took to it right out of the gate?
No, it wasn't tough. It was tough in the sense that when we came to town, Wisconsinites were not familiar with the NBA. They were a high school and college predominantly commanded the interest of basketball fans, and the NBA was something new. It was something different. It was something that a lot of people had not focused on. when we came in, the novelty in the fact that they had another major sports franchise in the city really took hold. And really, that was a part of my responsibility. I mean, I was told in no uncertain terms as the broadcaster to find ways to help put people in the seats, or else I'd be looking for another job opportunity the following year. So I set about doing some things that I thought were a little different, a little exciting, to try and capture the interest. And it was amazing how people bought into the team, the excitement of having a franchise in Milwaukee, and what we were doing on the radio, trying to create excitement. So from the get-go, even though that first year, as an expansion franchise, we won less than 30 games. The next year we won 55, and in the championship year we vaulted to 66. You know, that's an amazing jump. And in fact, the biggest jump in the history of professional sports to win, go from nothing to a championship in 3 years, that was at that time and may still be the greatest feat in the history of all pro sports. So the people in Milwaukee took to it. They were tremendous, great fans right from the get-go, enthusiasm, win or lose. And the whole idea was, if you went out there and gave it an effort as an expansion team back in that first season, people knew that they weren't going to get a volume amount of wins, but they wanted to see something that was growing, something that was going to be theirs for a long time. And so the excitement was there, win or lose, and the fans supported this franchise. It was really a very exciting and beautiful thing to see. And I think it opened the eyes of a lot of people around the country, because people are saying, Milwaukee, pro basketball, come on. And well, the come on was pretty darn good, because you see, it went from 25, 27 wins. I can't remember the exact. I think it was 27 wins in year one, which, incidentally, the Bucks have had worse years since then overall. And other franchises have won a whole lot less, 15, 16 games in a season. I think the Philadelphia team holds the record for the fewest wins, and that was 9. And so, you know, to be able to win as many games as we did in year one was really quite an accomplishment. And, of course, we kind of know the rest of the story, a lot of excitement, 66 wins. And 20 wins in a row during that year, the greatest winning streak in the history of sports up until the Lakers the following year. They won 33, and coincidentally, that streak was broken by the Bucks in January, on a cold January night. And you know, the other thing that goes kind of unnoticed in year three, it was the fact that we won 14 games in a row toward the end of the season. But during that entire run, from year one to two to three, you look at the attendance, they couldn't have shoehorned any more people into the old barn. So, you know, the attendance was really terrific. Year one, you know, picked up a little slowly. Year two, by year three, it was a full house all the time.
One of the ways that you you made things interesting on the radio, as I know many people know, is by coining the term Skyhook, which is now synonymous with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was, of course, the Bucks superstar back then, and really the driving force behind them becoming a team that could compete for a championship in that short period of time. I'm sure you've been asked to tell the story of where that term came from and how you coined it. Maybe if you could give me Cliff's Notes version of that. And then, similar to what we have now, again, Giannis Antetokounmpo is a star that everyone in the town is rallying behind. I'm sure it was similar to when Kareem was here, and I'm sure it was really tough for fans when he decided he wanted to play elsewhere.
You know, I want to just mention one thing before I get into the term, and that is Kareem, Giannis, the Bucks then, the Bucks now. I have got an eerie, crazy vibe, but there's a whole lot of similarity. When you look at the numbers and compare things then as to what the team did overall, Kareem's performance, around 32 points, 16 rebounds, what Giannis did this year, MVP, first time for Kareem in that championship year.
Mm-hmm, right.
Giannis has got a great shot at it now, along with the GM of the year, John Horst, who's done a tremendous job. President of the year, probably, in Peter Fagan. Giannis, the team, the coach of the year, possibly. we swept all the records and awards then, and you're liable to do the same thing now. So, you know, that's just one thing that's just been sitting on my head. The vibe is very, very similar, and that's a good vibe for all Bucks fans. But going back to the term, if I might use an analogy here, and I've never done it before, but I'm thinking, as you mentioned, that the term, and that is, the term Skyhook was kind of a, if I might use the term, it was kind of a pregnant term back then. I kind of flirted with it a little bit. I used it a couple of times, didn't do much, but it really gave birth in 1974 during the playoffs in the finals against the Boston Celtics. And that is the double overtime game against Havlicek and the Celtics when Kareem hit that skyhook going to the baseline over High Henry Finkel to win that second overtime game. But I kind of dabbled with it a little bit prior to that, but I really never said in my mind, this is indelible now. So skyhook, yes, no doubt. Easy. I mean, it was, you know, amongst the plethora of terms that I used, created back then, and had so much fun with, the skyhook was the one that really took off, and it's been something that has followed Kareem, and people ask me, well, how is it that you never got a lot of credit for it? I said, well, I'm not credit for it. He wrote the book. I just gave it a title, and but we've shared a lot of commonality in the use of that term over the years, and he's really himself given me full credit for that. And you know, it wasn't about credit; it was about trying to add to the broadcast and give something else for the fans in Wisconsin to really grab on to endear themselves to this team.
Yeah, it's like the Tommy John surgery in baseball. He was the patient and not the doctor. Frank Jobe did the surgery. How does he not get a little credit for it? But yeah, like you said, you got to have the patient. You got to have the player to make it happen.
Well, I mean, I look at a game, honestly, not to get off on track here of our conversation, but I look at the game on a nightly basis. I see people doing things, and it brings things to my mind that I want to compare with and come up with a name. I mean, you know, of course, obviously, Giannis now being the just incredible talent that he is, how he's changed the face of the game this year, but people calling him the Greek Freak. And I initially thought, geez, that's kind of a term that I don't know that a lot of Greek people might like that use of the word freak. So I came up with the Big Feta. Because, you know, who's a bigger cheese in Milwaukee or Wisconsin now than Giannis and the way he plays the game? I mean, he has really endeared people. So it was always, for me, an interesting challenge as I immersed myself in each game night to night to try and come up with something which would color the game, make it a little bit more exciting, a little bit more interesting, a little more enticing. And I had a lot of fun with it. It really kept me going. So nicknames, love them, still do, and would have a ball with some of the players playing today. I would tell you that.
So when I think with Giannis, there's maybe a back burner anxiety that Bucks fans have that, you know, he could theoretically leave Milwaukee someday looking for an opportunity to play in a bigger market. Doesn't seem like that's where we're headed, but it's possible. What did it do to Milwaukee fandom when Kareem decided he did want to go to Los Angeles? I know there were some hurt feelings. Kareem's been back. It's sort of that fence has been long ago mended, and he's been in Milwaukee for some of these games and some of these events. But what was the vibe like when you know, suddenly everything changed and Kareem went elsewhere?
Well, there was a hurt. There's no doubt about it. I think people, the Bucks fans, they hurt. They wanted this guy to love their community. And you know, honestly, the way Kareem handled this whole thing, he handled it with tremendous poise and professionalism. There wasn't a lot of the stuff in the papers or on radio and TV. Of course, it was a different era then. But he handled it as professionally as possible. He loved the people that he worked with in Milwaukee, Wes Pavlon, who was the principal owner at that time, and he were very, very close. And so they did everything possible to try and honor his request in an honorable way. And so for that reason, it was really handled very nicely. I mean, the package they got in return turned out to be terrific for the green and growing Bucks and helped vault them into a new era. But to lose a player like Kareem was hurtful. It was a mortal blow with the people who were so wrapped up in the franchise. There's no question about it. But he, and by the way, it wasn't just New York. I mean, L.A. It was also New York. There was a lot of conversation about him possibly going to New York. In fact, at one point, they were even talking about him living in New York and playing the games for the Bucks, joining us for games. Maybe having an apartment in New York and missing a lot of practices. And Kareem was the one that said, "Hey, I can't do that to my teammates." But that's how far the Bucks organization stretched at that point to try and keep him in Milwaukee. And eventually he went to L.A. and, you know, he ended up being happy, and the Bucks got it turned around. There was new ownership that came in, and the green and growing Bucks struggled for a few years, but finally got the thing headed in the right direction. You've got, you know, some pretty nice players in return, including Junior Bridgman, whose number is retired, Dave Myers, you know, Elmore Smith. There were some really, really good pieces that came this way. Six players, I think, overall. And, you know, that's the way life is. And nothing is going to be the same forever. And should Giannis at some point decide he wants to go elsewhere, hey, his prerogative. And with the way the media is today, I'm sure it would be blowing up into something which is bigger than he is. And that's a little bit unfortunate, because that would be even more hurtful. But you know what? Based on everything I hear, and the enthusiasm and passion that this young man has had and expressed for the community, which Kareem really never did, even though quietly he had a lot of respect. I mean, I had conversations with him after he left about how much he missed, you know, the camaraderie, the team, the certain people in the organization, the community, etc. I think Giannis has overtly expressed his passion for the city, his desire not to move. But you know what? The lure of the big dollar could change a whole lot of things. And, of course, with an agent getting involved and their expressed interest involved, meaning dollars and cents, that could change things in time. But right now, I think what Milwaukee should do and the state of Wisconsin should do, and that is enjoy the talent that this man brings to the party, enjoy the interest and following that he has created outside the state of Wisconsin, and just enjoy the fact that this guy is all about the game. And given what the Bucks organization and ownership, leadership have done to give back to the city, number one, and then to the players, creating an environment where people want to come and play, he may not want to leave. He's comfortable. He's going to get all the money that he needs eventually with a max contract. Now, if the bright lights in the big city and the gold sneakers are the allure, maybe things will change. But right now I'm thinking he likes the practice facility. They keep the lights on all night for him. He likes the new building, and he loves his team. And why not, regardless of what happens this year, the future is extremely bright. Why would he want to leave right now?
Yeah, that's a good point. So you, as you mentioned early on, they're trying to get back to the finals for the first time in 45 years since that 1974 team made the trip. And right. if you're my age in Milwaukee, 30s, 40s, you remember the 2001 team, the last team to make the finals before this year's team. And maybe not as much that those early 80s teams, because they didn't make the finals and there have been some recent successes since then. Maybe they kind of fall into a gap where fans don't remember how good those teams were. And that's kind of at the tail end of your time with the Bucks, and Don Nelson is the coach. As you look back at those early 80s Bucks teams, what really sticks out? Like what maybe a player or a couple moments, like what are the things that you really remember about those squads?
Well, first of all, the 74 team should have won it, okay? Milwaukee should have had two championships. That was the series where the away team was having success on the home team's floor. And we go to Boston. We lose game six in the double overtime. And then Boston comes to Milwaukee after winning that double OT on a Friday night. And less than 48 hours later, beats the Bucks on their home floor on a Sunday afternoon. And that was really one that is not talked about too much. But that was a heartbreaker. We should have had that. And in talking to Oscar subsequently in recent years, he even thinks that we should have won as many as three titles. But there was some tweaking that went on with the roster and some things that happened that didn't happen. So, you know, that being history and having been said, we had a lot of great moments. Into the 80s, Don Nelson took the team. And Don Nelson, to his credit, was a coach that was a novice coach who had tried out to become an official before he became an assistant with the Bucks and didn't make the cut, and then ended up as an assistant with Larry Costello, and then eventually gets the job as the head coach. And what you had to love about Don Nelson was he was an innovator, not an imitator, which is what I always tried to think that I was. And Don Nelson created offenses that nobody had ever seen. We're seeing a little bit of the same thing here with Coach Bud, because he's restructured this offense. This is a three-point offense. And they spread the floor. They create all kinds of problems where they stretch the defense. Nelson came up with things like the point forward and did some crazy things with his personnel that enabled him to win. I mean, they had several division titles during Nelly's years in the 80s. So those were very, very good teams. They had problems getting by Philadelphia, had problems with some of the other teams along the way. But those were good teams, just not quite good enough. Didn't have that big hook and ladder in the middle that could really create problems. The present team with Giannis, and you're looking at five players playing out of position at times, according to the way the game used to be played. You're playing against a team with a guy that can play five positions, and you're playing with a center, a seven-footer, who's playing outside the three line, and you're playing with other people. It's incredible. So there is a comparison in the creativity that both of these coaches, Nelson then and Coach Bud now, have employed to create a winning combination, a winning franchise, and given the fans what they have today. This team that they have in Milwaukee now is really incredible when you take a look at it and the way they play the game. The way they stretch the floor, the way they play, Giannis being able to play so many positions, other people, the Middleton. I mean, you play Giannis in deep, you got Middleton on the outside, you've got Lopez, who's had incredible nights at times, you've got Bledsoe, who can get to the rim as well as anybody. You have a team that can play defense, a team that is complementary, a team that is incredibly deep. And here's where the Bucks really have an advantage. Their depth is very, very good, and I owe a lot of that to young GM John Horst, who's made some significant trades, acquisitions. So they create multiple problems for the teams that they play. And herein is where I think they have the edge over Toronto. I think this is the matchup they wanted. I don't know, but, you know, me looking at it, I think Philadelphia had better talent, but I think that they were less organized. I think Toronto with Kawhi presented a different kind of a problem. So home court advantage is going to be big. I think game one is going to be very, very big. You got to get that home court because Toronto, like the Bucks, very tough at home. But I didn't mean to digress again, but I mean, you know, when you compare the early 80s with Nelson, the innovator, with this team, Coach Bud, an innovator, you get other teams, and I always remember Doug Moe, who was coaching at Denver at a time during the 90s, 80s. Doug Moe said, you know, I don't even worry about scouting other teams. I let them worry about scouting us because I'm going to play my game and I'm going to create problems for them. So they have to match up with me. Worry about that matchup, not me matching up or worrying about them. And I think that's what the Bucks have done. Oh, yeah, they scout. Don't get me wrong. But pretty much you got to be concerned about what Milwaukee's going to do because they give you so much to look at from so many different ways. And the angles that they create going to the basket, creating basket opportunities for other floors, players on the floor, because they use up that floor. I mean, you know, I hate to let my mind wander here, but when I watch the Bucks play, and I have watched them play extensively this year, I follow the team very closely. It's really a team that I consider my team in terms of my favorite team. I look at a team that is playing on a canvas like an artist, and I look at Giannis as being the guy that's got the paintbrush in his hand. And what he's doing on that canvas is pretty much creating a picture for people who watch the game or who follow the game to be enthralled by the different pictures that he can create from night to night because the canvas is his. They give him the ball. He brings it up. He can do what he wants because it's wide open. He can dish it. He can shoot it. He can dribble into traffic and create opportunities inside with the inside handoff, passing ability. You know, he's even learning to shoot the deep ball a little better. His face-up mid-range game is getting better. His basket, his moves to the basket, you know, are incredible. And then his ability to pass. So look at the floor as being a canvas. And look at artists as being the guy with the brush. And look at the other people around him as the people that are handling the oils for him to dip that brush into and create that picture. It's a marvelous thing to think about because it is artistic. And whether people want to believe that basketball or sports is artistic or not, all they have to do is look at the Bucks and the way they play the game. It can be as much of a work of art on most nights. And they did it 60 times during the regular season. They've won it, done it 8 times in a row during the playoffs. And if I had to make a bet, I would say they're going to do it again in this final round of the Eastern Conference and during the championship. That's the vibe that I'm getting. Very similar to what I saw with the Bucks in 1971.
That would be extremely encouraging. That should be extremely encouraging to Bucks fans. Before I let you go, I want to just know what else you're up to these days. I know you came back to Milwaukee, I believe in 2013, around the time you went into the Basketball Hall of Fame to call a game with Ted Davis, and I know that you're back a lot for the Mac Fund. Clearly, you have NBA League Pass, and I've been watching NBA basketball as much as you obviously know about the Bucks here. What other things have you been up to? I know you live in California, correct?
I do live in California. And I do get back to Milwaukee. In fact, planning on getting back there in a couple of weeks for our Mac Fund Trek 100 bike ride. Hope to be there, God willing. And then, of course, that would be on a Saturday, the 1st of June. And then on Monday the 3rd is our Mac Fund golf outing. Try to get back when I can for board meetings, if it's at all possible. And, you know, we have family back there as well. So, and my wife's family is back there. So try to get back there for that. And I have business reasons to get back there as well. So, listen, the Milwaukee, Wisconsin is still very much a part of my life. It'll never be any different than that. It's my favorite place. And if I hadn't had to take a shot at some advanced career moves, I'd still be there. And of course, my son's illness at the time, we created the Mac Fund. The Mac Fund has been a wonderful thing, and I thank all the fans of Wisconsin for the support, huge support that they've given us in the way it has grown over the years and the success that the Mac Fund has had, not only in Wisconsin, but the surrounding states. We're the St. Jude's of the upper Midwest. So, you know, that's been the greatest legacy I could possibly have. I mean, I don't want to take anything away from Bangle. That's a legacy, too. But
that's true.
The Mac Fund is easily the greatest legacy I have. I also work for a company that's located in the Midwest, creating relationships and maintaining those relationships, and that's Horner Sports Flooring. And we manufacture probably a third of the NBA floors, the Wisconsin floor, the Marquette floor.
NCAA tournament, right?
Manufactured. So Horner Sports Flooring takes up a lot of my time as well.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. I know you'll be enjoying the Bucks here as they head into the Eastern Conference Finals. Thank you so much, sir. I really appreciate the time.
JR, listen, it's Eddie. It'll always be Eddie. And I sure miss the folks back there, and I'm looking forward to this game and the series against the Toronto Raptors.
That's it, supersized edition of the Milwaukee Bucks Journal Sentinel podcast this week. Thanks for tuning in. As I said after we spoke with Matt Velasquez, we'll be back with you in a couple weeks. We'll preview the drafts. We'll look at what the Bucks' options might be. Again, focus on some of the things they might need to take that next step for next year and what's going on with free agency. And that, like you said, begins on June 30th. So there's still a month to go before we get to that point, but there will certainly be some storylines that have emerged. Thanks to Matt Velasquez and Eddie Doucette for joining me on this edition of the Milwaukee Bucks Journal Sentinel podcast. Find us on Stitcher, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Leave us a rating and review. Please, please, please leave us that rating, that review. Do it right now. Help us out. Give us your feedback. We'd love it. Or you can find me on Twitter. I'm JR Radcliffe at JRRADCLIFFE. Thanks for tuning in. We'll catch you again very soon.